does a 9-year-old girl seemingly disappear off the face of the earth? How does that happen? How do you not know what happened to your little girl? That is the nightmare that Debbie Randall's parents live through.
Crime Stories with Nancy Grace.
What happened when Debbie Randall, just 9 years old, goes missing? I'm Nancy Grace. This is Crime Stories. Take a listen now to our friends at WXIA 11 Alive, Jessica Knoll.
January 13th, 1972. At that time, Debbie Lynn's family lived in an apartment complex on one side of the street, and the laundromat where she was abducted sat on the other.
I think it was like 57 feet from her front door to the laundromat.
The 57 feet was all Debbie Lynn's kidnapper needed. Her mother found the box of soap she tried to bring home scattered on the ground. Detective Morris Nix was a teen when it happened.
I remember vividly. I came in the house. It was on the news. People were afraid. They were angry. And it was frightening.
With me, an all-star panel to break it down and put it back together again. The detective who has worked this case for so long, Detective Morris Nix, owner Nix & Associates, also polygraph examiner, 38 years in law enforcement. Guy Watkins, member of Cobb County District Attorney's Cold Case Unit, now Gatekeeper Global at gatekeeperglobal.com. Joseph Scott Morgan, professor of forensics, Jacksonville State University, and author of Blood Beneath My Feet on Amazon. Dr. Bethany Marshall, psychoanalyst, joining us out of Beverly Hills at drbethanymarshall.com. But now to Cheryl McCollum, director and founder of the Cold Case Research Institute. I want to start at the beginning, Cheryl. Tell me how Debbie Randall, just 9 years old, goes missing.
Nancy, it was a Thursday night, January 13th, 1972. And Debbie, I mean, she's adorable. She's freckle-faced little 9-year-old girl. She loves her dolls. She loves playing with her friends. Her mom is not feeling well. So her stepfather says, me and Debbie will go across the street and do the laundry. Her brothers stay home because they're going to be with their mom and they're watching their favorite show, The Rifleman. So they go literally 57 feet door to door and they start doing the laundry. When it's finished, Debbie asked if she can stay and play with these little girls whose mom is washing clothes and folding laundry. He said yes, but be home by 7:30. No problem. So they're playing together, and he leaves. About 7:30, she doesn't get home, and her parents begin to worry about her, so they go looking for her at the laundromat. And there on the ground, they see the detergent that she was carrying spilled in the ground next to a VW bug.
A bug, not a van.
Correct.
The reason I ask, because if it's a bug, someone walking by, driving by, might see what happened. If it's a van and she's on the other side of the van, it would be totally obscured from vision. But you're saying the laundry detergent is found by a VW bug, correct?
Correct, but spilled all over the parking area.
Okay, let's go straight out to Detective Morris Nix, who 38 years in law enforcement, on the case. To Detective Nix, thank you for being with us, Detective Nix. I want to analyze what we know so far about Debbie Randall's disappearance. We know that Debbie Lynn Randall, shoulder-length brown hair. That evening, she had it tied back in a yellow bow. And she has big green eyes. She goes with her stepfather. They go over to the laundromat just 57 feet from their apartment. She wants to play with the little girls. I thought some of them had dolls. And the dad says, yes, fine, but be home in X number of minutes. And she agrees. And she's never seen alive again. Take me up from the beginning to that point where we find the detergent strewn all out in the parking lot. Start at the beginning and take me to the laundry detergent, Detective Nix.
Okay, we know that Debbie stayed behind and played with the dolls. When she got ready to leave, she took the box with her.
Hold on.
Angel dust.
What? Who had the dolls?
Debbie had a doll. Debbie had a doll.
She brought a doll with her. Okay.
They were playing dolls. I don't know if she had a doll with her.
Okay.
One of the people that I talked to said that that was common. They would meet there and play with their dolls. Once she left, she went around the corner. She come out the door, you go around the corner, and that's where she was abducted. Now, I talked to one girl.
Wait, explain to me. Hold on. I want to hear about the soap detergent. You're taking me up to the point of the soap detergent. Why was that? Did her dad leave her with soap detergent? Was she supposed to bring that home? Explain.
I haven't asked him if he specifically left her with detergent. Someone told me that Debbie would do just what she did. She would gather what was left and take it with her. I don't know if she had the box with her or if she picked it up inside the laundromat.
Okay, you're cutting out on me, Detective Nix, and I really want to hear every single word you say. It's my understanding, not only did she love to play with her dolls, she was the neighborhood baseball team queen, and she collected and stacked soap boxes. She collected leftover detergent and would gather it together and take it home to her mother. Is that correct, Detective Nix?
That is correct. That
Explain.
Is something she just developed a habit of doing. She collected the soap powder or detergent. When she left, another little girl wanted to go with her. And her older sister said, no, you're going to stay here and help fold clothes. So I asked her, I said, when Debbie went around the corner, do you think she ran into someone she knew, or do you think someone just happened to be there? She is convinced that Debbie ran into someone that she knew, and he probably called her over to the vehicle.
Just one second before I go any further. I've gotten a lot of emails and texts regarding the parents. To Dr. Bethany Marshall, psychoanalyst, joining me out of Beverly Hills at drbethanymarshall.com. Dr. Bethany, the parents have taken a lot of grief because they let her play with her friends. And I would just want to remind everyone that this neighborhood had practically zero crime. And she was 57 feet away.
Crime Stories with Nancy Grace.
Guys, we're talking about a 9-year-old little girl, Debbie Lynn Randall, who's 57 feet away from her parents at a laundromat. And she goes missing. For instance, in the book that I am just finishing, Don't Be a Victim, I talk about children going to playgrounds or ballparks. And the parent may go get hot dogs or corn dog or drinks and then come back. And their children are there playing. That is basically, that's tantamount to what happened here. It's just...
Well, Nancy...
Go ahead.
You know, if a predator wants to get a child, they will... It's what we call a crime of opportunity. So they are going to look for the one moment that the child is temporarily out of eyesight. And we can't keep our children in cages. You're right. This was just... I think this was a... This laundromat was half a block from the family's apartment complex. And remember, she was playing with another little girl. That little girl had parents there, a mother there. So that implies that she was left in the supervision of other adults. She wasn't just roaming the streets by herself, but this other little girl wasn't. Remember,
not
the detective
at
just
all.
Said that. No.
You know,
remember Madeline McCann?
I was just thinking about that. Now, those parents were like at least one football field away. Their children were asleep in a vacation rental. They were having dinner with friends that evening, and they would go back and check on Maddie McCann every 20 minutes. And the last time they went back to check on them, the other children were there, and Maddie McCann was gone. And those parents have taken so much H-E-double-L about that. But to Joe Scott Morgan, professor of forensics, Jacksonville State University, I want to talk about the scene where all the laundry detergent was found strewn across the parking lot where the VW bug was. What does that tell you? Tells me there was a struggle.
Yeah, potentially a struggle. And let's also keep in mind, this is one interesting little fact that I've kind of dug out and was just kind of curious to me. Immediately adjacent to the strewn detergent on the ground, where you were talking about this VW bug, all right? Mm-hmm. And one of the things that keeps coming up over and over again is that there was a tiny handprint that was found on the surface of this bug. It implies, at least, that it's on the side of the bug, okay? And the interesting thing about it is the position of the print. The print is essentially with the hands facing downward. If the listeners will put their hands down by their side and turn their palms facing backwards, this print was inverted just like that and was found on the side of the car. Now, I think my question as a forensics guy, were they ever able to tie that print back to this child's hand? All they're saying is that it was a small handprint, and it was apparently adjacent to the soap powder. And I think that's significant because, you know, we can only get into that position, Nancy, if we're kind of backing up and bracing ourselves as we back into a surface. Everybody's done this at some point in time to kind of catch yourself, or if we're forced backwards. Okay, so that kind of goes along with the potential for a struggle.
And let me now go to Guy Watkins, member Cobb County District Attorney's Cold Case Unit, now at Gatekeeper Global, LLC. Guy Watkins, was there an attempt to match that palm print up to Debbie Randall?
Honestly, I do not remember any notation in the file that we had that there was that attempt, but Sure,
I'm looking right at that palm print. What do you know, Morris Nix? Do we know if the palm print was matched up to Debbie?
It was not. That was my understanding.
Did they try to match it and it wasn't a match, or was it never attempted?
It was my understanding that they simply discarded it on the scene.
Joe Scott Morgan, if you and I have the palm print, that means it can still be matched.
Yeah, it's quite possible that you could match a palm print but this is the problem. If there was a full palm print taken of her at the medical examiner's office when the body was examined at that point in time, most of the time when bodies come into the ME's office, they only do fingerprints most of the time.
Really?
Particularly back then.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Okay, to Cheryl McCollum, hold on, jump in. What about this palm print?
Nancy, if it was discarded at the scene, the reason that would have been happening is if you look at the VW, if it's dusty or has pollen on it, you're not going to get any friction ridge definition.
I can see it. I can
right.
already
can see,
see the ridges
the
on the fingers. No, I see the ridges on the fingertips too, Cheryl. You got to look at this print, especially on the thumb. I mean, I see a great print on the thumb. It's a fantastic print as far as fingerprint.
I thought Detective Nick said it was discarded at the scene. I don't know why.
Well, if I've got it, somebody's got it. But you know what? For years, I heard defense attorneys argue, there's no fingerprints. Therefore, we don't have a case. But that's not necessarily true. Take a listen to your cut 8. This is me talking to a witness, Sandra Walker.
Sandra, I know it was a while back, but please put your mind back to the evening Debbie disappeared. What did you observe?
They did not get her where they thought they got her. There was like a playground that was behind the laundromat and also a place there where you would go and get lawnmowers to cut people's grass. And there was a tree right there beside the laundromat where there was no windows or anything on the side. I seen this black pickup truck stop The driver got out, left his door open, left the truck running. He ran. He went over to Debbie. He grabbed her, and she was kicking her feet and kicking real hard and screaming and yelling. And he had her over his shoulder, so she was screaming and kicking. He threw her in the truck, and then he almost ran over me.
So, guys, you know, yes, I wish we had had a match on that handprint of Debbie Randall leaning back against that VW bug when she was kidnapped. But I have her laundry detergent that she had collected, and she would take home in a laundromat. People don't use all their laundry detergent. She would gather it up and take it home to her mother to save money. She'd take the excess laundry detergent home. We have that strewn all over the parking lot. Not only that, we now have a witness that states she was taken forcibly by a man in a black pickup. Now, she is a child witness at the time. And let me tell you something, in courts of law, very often child witnesses are treated as less important than adult witnesses. It's my experience, just the opposite. I think children make much better witnesses than adults do. But let's see what Sandra Walker has to say about an ID of the kidnapper.
What did the truck look like?
All I know is it was a black truck because I was 12 years old. Mm-hmm. But I can remember it like it was yesterday. I've had nightmares about it forever.
What did he look like?
He was a white man. And I was maybe 140 feet to 180 feet from him, so I couldn't tell you what he looked like. But I could tell he was white.
And do you recall what he had on?
He had a pants and shirt, but I mean, other than that, I just looked...
Long pants.
Yeah, long pants and a shirt. And I remember it because I looked at somebody that was walking with me. I said, "Did you just see that?" And when I heard her screaming and yelling, I said, "Ooh, somebody done got in trouble."
Crime Stories with Nancy Grace.
Guys, the disappearance of a 9-year-old little girl goes unsolved. Is there a chance to solve it now? Debbie Randall's parents tortured over her disappearance. The search was massive. To Detective Morris Nix, who's been on the case from the get-go, this little girl gets reported missing. Tell me about the beginning of the search that Thursday night. What happened?
Well, Marietta sent out people in the neighborhood, knocking on doors, trying to get information. They did not get very much. At that point, they started trying to organize, and people quickly volunteered. We had college students. They had helicopters, Boy Scout troops.
Whoa. Wait a minute. So you got Boy Scout troops, helicopters, scores of volunteers all out looking for Debbie Randall. Take a listen now. After a massive search, what we know. This is True Crime Chronicle, Jessica Knoll.
On a chilly, rainy day, 16 days after she disappears, thousands in a search party comb through a heavily wooded area. 4.5 hours into their search, a man discovers drag marks dug into the wet ground.
Her body was discovered by Mike McMahon, and he was a student at Southern Tech. And a group of students had agreed to search, and that's the area that they were assigned to. And Mike said that he had just gotten back from Vietnam, had seen a lot of combat in Vietnam. And he said when he went there, he noticed there appeared to be drag marks. And so he followed the drag mark down there. He spotted Debbie's body, and he stopped. He didn't go all the way down to the body. And that's how she was found.
You know, what's interesting to Cheryl McCollum, very often the person that finds the body is immediately under suspicion. Not true in this case. to my understanding, because this was someone that had been solicited and volunteered to search.
Absolutely. He was a war hero. He had just been home. He's at the college. He volunteers to help. And he has a reason to take that path. He does recognize track marks. He had seen it in Vietnam. And it was about 150 feet into the woods, Nancy. And again, he didn't go any further. He didn't disturb it at all. So, you know, nothing that would have belonged to him or would pinpoint him in any way was ever on her. So he did everything right.
Guys, we are talking about the disappearance of Debbie Lynn Randall. She's a third grader, a third grade girl. Take a listen to our friend WXIA 11 Alive, Jessica Knowles.
Her brother was at the store handing out flyers, if you had seen her, that she had come up missing. And that's when I put two and two together.
And she still carries the heartache of what happened that day.
I've had people say that you got to let it go. And I can't. When her little girl didn't deserve any, she deserved to have the life.
Debbie Lynn was found 16 days later during a mass search of the woods. It was cold and rainy.
She was abducted in one area, attacked in another area, redressed, and then her body was taken to even another area on Johnson Ferry Road.
Police say Debbie Lynn had been found raped and suffocated, the killer likely using her own coat to muffle her screams.
Like, take a listen to more of what we learn about the crime scene from Jessica Knoll.
Her lifeless body is fully clothed, wearing a long-sleeved lavender dress with small yellow flowers and tiny green leaves, and a dark blue hooded coat zipped all the way up to her chin. She's wearing bobby socks, but her favorite lavender Christmas shoes are missing. She's been suffocated with her own coat. Investigators believe the man covered her face, possibly to muffle her screams. She's missing an ear and has been violently raped. Dark brown hair is found on her body and is tested. It's from a white male, approximately 18 to 30 years old, and may be dark complected.
I think there's a really good chance that possibly Debbie knew her abductor.
The body is found. This little girl, you know what? I'll let Detective Nix tell you. With me, Detective Morris Nix. Detective Nix, what happened to Debbie Randall? How was she killed? What did she endure before her death?
Nancy, it's almost indescribable. Debbie was taken to a place. She was assaulted with a foreign object. She was...
Wait a minute. When you say assaulted with a foreign object...
Yes, ma'am.
Don't talk to me like a cop. That means she was raped with something, like a bottle or a can or something.
Correct. In one part of the report, it says they think it may have been a shock absorber. I have no idea why they said that. Possibly a bottle. She was torn open. She was bleeding profusely. At some point, her attacker takes a rag, a cloth, inserts it in the vaginal area. We believe he did this because she was bleeding so badly, and he knew that he was going to put her back in his vehicle. And that's why I believe that he had to move the body, because where this assault occurred, he was familiar with that location. And it was a very isolated location. You would have to have known it was there. And once he gets her back in the truck, he only takes her just a very short ways down the road. I think either one, she was bleeding in his truck profusely, or two, she wasn't dead. You know, my prayer is that she was. But he stops the vehicle right down the street, takes her over into the woods. That place, it was wooded then, but the place now was where the Houston restaurant was on Pilots Ferry Road. It was a horrific assault. And he leaves her there.
I don't think that was planned. I don't think he thought, I'm going to assault her here and take her right down the street. I think something all of a sudden made him stop there. Otherwise, he would have gone down perhaps to the river. But he stopped just right down the street. I think he says, uh-oh, there's a problem. So she's either leaving a lot of blood in his truck or, again, to a deceased. The depravity of this mind is something I've tried all these years to wrap my head around. I just don't understand how you do that. But
I do know this, to Guy Watkins, member of Cobb County District Attorney's Cold Case Unit, now with Gatekeeper Global, LLC. Guy, I do know that she was alive for the horrific and brutal rape. As Nick just said, possibly with a shock absorber on this 9-year-old third grader because of the profuse bleeding. If she was dead at the time of the sex assault and sodomy, she would not have bled so much. So I know that she is alive and endured that. What was she asphyxiated, Guy Watkins?
I believe that she was asphyxiated with her own dress. There were certainly DNA samples that were taken from her clothing and from her and also from the victim.
Crime Stories with Nancy Grace.
Guys, we're talking about Debbie Randall, a third grader who goes missing from the laundromat. And after a massive search involving college students, war vets, and Boy Scouts, her body is found in a remote and isolated area. To Dr. Bethany Marshall, psychoanalyst joining us from Beverly Hills, what does it say to you that she was then redressed to a T in the outfit she had gotten for Christmas? That's what she was wearing, minus the little lavender shoes she had gotten for Christmas. Remember, this is in January.
Right.
What does it tell you? Do you remember Ted Bundy? After he would rape and murder his victims, he would then bathe them, sometimes do their hair and makeup, and redress them. What does that mean?
Well, I would love to first address the shock absorber and the bleeding before how he dressed her, if you don't mind. I think it's important for the listeners to know that there is more than one MO when it comes to child abduction. One is to possess and control the child and to have sex with the child. But the other is something called sadism, where you purposely inflict pain and cruelty because the sexual satisfaction comes from the terror that you're inflicting on the child. And usually with this, we see anal and genital mutilation. We see burn marks on the child's body. If I heard correctly, an ear was missing. I mean, I'm wondering, how did that happen? I mean, if the MO is just plain old sexual satisfaction and the orientation is towards children, he would have had intercourse with her and then dumped her, killed her so she couldn't ID him. But in this case, he wanted to torture her. Then he dresses her, and I heard some report that he put her underwear back on in a peculiar way, which I would love to know more about. But I think there is some strange thing that happens after somebody commits homicide, that they temporarily humanize the body. You'll often see, like, you once told a story of somebody dying in a driveway, and the person who finds him puts a pillow under his head. Or we see people who have been disposed of in the forest, but they have a blanket over them. And I think sometimes there's a peculiar type of humanity that enters after the horrific crime.
To Cheryl McCollum, forensics expert, founder of the Cold Case Research Institute, weigh in on the crime scene, Cheryl.
For me, the 150 feet into the woods is significant. Again, he knew the area. There's no doubt in my mind about that. This is an organized killer. He had transportation. He had the object for rape. He had the location for the assault. He had the ability after the fact to cover her face. This was planned. This is somebody that was a predator that sat between a laundromat and a playground. And if you think about any laundromat you've ever seen, in the front is a bank of windows. So he's able to watch those children in the laundromat just as openly as he can watch the children in the playground. And he waited. He waited for the perfect opportunity. And sadly, that happened.
Let me ask you something, Cheryl McCollum. We know that she had a white male's dark brown hair or brown hair on her person. What about the possibility, even now, to do a genome study?
It's crazy that you just mentioned that. Literally 3 days ago, I spoke with an expert that has developed a way to get DNA from a rootless hair. And I cannot wait to talk to Detective Nix and share that information with him and the person's phone number. We've had hair before on cold cases, but without the root, we were never able to extract the DNA. It's possible now. So this is a good opportunity to once again tell people, sometimes science catches up.
You know, explain just in a nutshell very quickly to Joseph Scott Morgan, forensics expert, what we're talking about when we say a genome study and how significant that may be to this case.
Well, I think that what's going to be significant is if they can apply what we know, perhaps like, for instance, with the Golden State Killer, where we can go back and find DNA or partial DNA and track this back through a familial line. I got to tell you, Nancy, based on what I have heard and what I've read, I don't think this is this guy's first time out
of the
gate.
Okay, whoa. I agree with all of that, but my specific question to you, objection, Judge, not responsive to the question. Let me just tell you, I'll Q&A with myself for a moment, Joe Scott. The genome study, while it cannot act as DNA, deoxyribonucleic acid, what it can do is basically give us a composite sketch of the perp. We could possibly find out what color his eyes are. Hit me, Cheryl. Take Joe Scott Morgan to school in a nutshell.
They use phenotyping, and when they get that phenotype, it will tell you complexion, hair color, whether or not they have freckles, their race. It can tell you, you know, basically this is what the killer looked like. It will give you literally a composite.
So, Joe Scott Morgan, now I want you to do what you do best. Analyze the death scene, especially that missing ear.
Yeah, this
on a 9-year-old girl. I mean, how can I even say with a straight face a missing ear? The little girl is raped, possibly with a shock absorber. The guy plugs a rag in this little girl, this third grade girl's vagina, so she'll stop bleeding on his truck, then totally dresses her in her Christmas outfit and dumps her body. That's the way you have to tell a jury. Is it nice? Is it pretty? No, it's not. But I want this guy in jail. So hit me, Joe Scott. Give me everything you got on the crime scene.
Yeah, it's ugly stuff and messy business, Nancy. Let's start with the ear. The ear is significant to me because this can go down two ways. Either this was done, the ear was removed, and I've had cases where ears have literally been ripped off. If you've got an adult male going up against a very young girl, that's possible. However, I think what I want to know is, was the ear dissected off? Did it have clean margins? Did the individual actually use a sharp instrument to remove this ear? And secondly, was it done antemortem before death, or was it done postmortem? And thirdly, did they ever recover the ear? And this is important because we got to tie this back with these shoes that she was in love with. Because of all of the serial homicide cases I've worked, there have been a certain group of them that are trophy takers. And so this is something that they could potentially hold on to. Now, I have to go back for a moment relative to this ear. Let's go back to the year. It was 1972. There were a lot of guys coming home from Vietnam. My dad was one of them, okay? One of the things that you hear about and you see about from Vietnam are something called ear necklaces. And these necklaces were literally created literally created from ears that were taken from the enemy. And there are pictures, people can search this out, there are pictures of our troops in Vietnam wearing ear necklaces. So in this particular point in time, I'm really wondering if this individual had not seen these images before, or were they a vet, perhaps, that had been traumatized by the war?
Now, may I interrupt?
Jump in quickly.
That ear, it was partially missing, and it was attributed to wild animals because she had laid in the wood for like 16 days.
Okay.
That is a possibility. Yep. What about the attempt to obscure the body, Joe Scott, if you could touch on that?
Well, you know, she's so far off of the road, just like Cheryl had mentioned, she is essentially obscured. This individual would have known something about her. But I think that what I want to know, was the body actually posed in any particular way? Was she, say, for instance, spread eagle on the ground? Was she face up, face down? Was her buttocks raised in the air? Were her hips elevated in the air?
Wait a minute. Detective Nix, was she face up or face down?
She was actually on her side. She was dumped.
Dumped. Okay, what does that mean to you, Joe Scott?
Well, that would mean that the individual had done this in a rather rapid moment. Just as the detective said earlier, this gives us an indication to this sudden stark realization this individual comes to where she's bleeding out. He's got to get rid of the body. Remember, this is on what's called Powers Ferry Road, the river, the Chattahoochee River, which we all know about because of Wayne Williams. Many years later, it would have been a prime dumping area. You know, all the evidence would have been washed away, but he couldn't quite make it there. He had to get her off the truck. And if he leaves her in this kind of what we call in medicine a left or right recumbent position, that means on your side, maybe fetal position, that means that he's not taking a lot of time at the scene. So that would have given the detectives at that point in time an indication that this may have been a frenzied event.
Last question to you. Frenzied, how does that jive with redressing her?
As far as redressing, Nancy, I would really like to know how she was redressed. You know, they throw this term around a lot. I've actually heard somebody say that she may have been suffocated at one point in time with her own jacket. Well, how is that possible if the jacket is on her body and zipped all the way up? You know,
well, I mean, she obviously was redressed because her underwear were put back on. So what does redressing mean to you? And what does the fact that her shoes are missing mean to you?
Well, again, with the shoes, I think that this is key. A lot has been made out of these shoes. She was proud of these shoes. Well, who in her little orbit that she lived in that particular time would have had an awareness that she had brand new shoes? These little shoes she had gotten at Christmas. Who would have known about how much pride she would take in these shoes? Did she show them off? Did she talk about them? Hey, look at my new shoes.
So you believe they were taken as a trophy?
That's my suspicion, yes.
Guys, the tip line in the death, the brutal murder of Debbie Randall, 770-528-3032. Repeat, 770-528-3032. For more in-depth information, go to crimeonline.com. Nancy Grace, Crime Story, signing off. Goodbye, friend.